Okay, just starting the recording a little late there, but we're in part two of the final lecture, and we're on slide 11 for anyone listening to the recording. And we're talking about this making possible and the binding, the making possible that holds itself before what is possibly actual. Do you see we've got these the meeting of these two streams? There is also, he's saying, a determinacy that is proper to that which is possible. And that determinacy is informed by what the binding that has already occurred. So the second paragraph, for whatever is possible does not become more possible through indeterminacy, so that everything possible would, as it were, find room to be accommodated in it. Rather, whatever is possible grows in its possibility and in the force that makes it possible through restriction. Every possibility brings its intrinsic restriction with it. So the meaning that I tease out of that is that what's being actualized now is like a channel that is forcing what is possible into a narrower and narrower field of possibility. And in that restriction, do you see in that narrowing of what is possible, almost the energy of the possibility is raised. So your projecting into what is possible is constrained by what you've just bound yourself to. Not that you're aware of doing that. And then the very potentiality of the possibility of what can occur in your life is bounded by that. But in that binding, the possibility, you see, it's like you've got a certain amount of energy of possibility in your projecting, and the narrower the boundaries of that possibility become, the more energetic, if you like, the more possible the possibilities that you're projecting become. The possibility of their being actual is raised. Last paragraph. But the restriction of the possible is here that which is in each case precisely actual. So he's just expanding what I'm saying. It's the actual that constrains or constricts, what's the word he's using? Restricts what is possible. And he says, that expansiveness that can be filled. So, I mean, here he's talking about something that he later came to call, I think, the clearing of being. Right, the clearing of being is that expansiveness within which being is able to manifest, it's manifesting out of the making possible that we are projecting. So we are projecting a making possible into the clearing of being, where our making possible meets with the possibly actual and manifests the world. Now I'm hoping now, you see, do you see how Heidegger is? I can hear it over here. There's another part of me that hears this, and it's almost complete nonsense, isn't it? Do you know there's a level where it's almost complete nonsense, where it's almost saying nothing, and yet there's a thread of intelligibility in it, if you can follow it, that actually does describe something. This manifesting of world, that for us, when as soon as we think about it, it's already manifest, done, all we see are beings, already laid out, already manifest, already fixed. And Heidegger's trying to take us back into this place of manifestation, where the possible is becoming actual. Every moment the possible is actualizing. Let me just read this paragraph again from the beginning. But the restriction of the possible is here that which in each case is that which is in each case precisely actual, that expansiveness that can be filled, i.e. that as a whole out of which our comportment comports itself in each case. You see, because we're projected ourselves into this expansiveness. We're not, this is Heidegger's big difference, I think, from Husserl. He's not taking up the place of some kind of disembodied godlike observer of this process. He's saying we actually are this process. There's nobody standing outside of it looking on.
But then where does new stuff come from? Because if everything is, we're predicting from what we already know, we've already experienced, then surely we should just keep getting the same thing.
Well, no, because I prefer projection, I like it. Our projection of possibility is meeting with something actual.
Mm-hmm.
Or possibly actual, right? And the possibly actual holds the possibility of something new in it. And our holding ourselves out into the openness of this place is our allowing our making possible. You see, our making possible isn't fixed. It's informed by what has been made actual already. Do you see? So it's in a certain level, it's able to be informed by the possibly actual. And something that was, do you see, once something possible becomes actual, it changes the structure of what we think is possible. Not what we think is possible in reflection, but what we experience as being possible. So there's something coming from the possibly actual, from the side of being, that we allow ourselves to, you know, this, our being bound to it, our binding with it means that it can inform us, and there's room for something new to enter into us in that binding. If we didn't, what you were describing in a way would be, if we didn't bind with the possibly actual, then that's what we would do. We would just be cycling around in a sort of a fixed set of possibilities from which we could never get any further, if you like.
Which is what some people do.
Yes. Yeah. That's, in a way, that can be called, for many people, old age. the refusal to bind to anything new at all, you know. If you just project your possibilities out there, and if something doesn't agree with them, then you don't see it. And yeah. To an extent, we are all a bit like that. You know, we all have that. Something has to actually, you know, thrust itself towards us before we recognize it. So where am I? We must therefore say that this single occurrence of projecting in the unity of its essence raises us away in binding us to what is possible, and this simultaneously means it expands into a whole. It holds this before it. The projection is intrinsically completing in the sense of a casting ahead, that is the forming of an as a whole, in whose realm there is spread out a quite specific dimension of possible actualization. So, are you getting a sense here that in our making possible, we're laying out something complete in its possibility, within which the world is going to manifest itself in its actuality. Are you getting a slight hint of it? So
I have trouble with like whole and complete imply finished, and that's limited, and but it would be something completely unlimited. So our idea of a whole would have to be not what my idea of a whole.
Yes.
Like a whole, there's a whole and it's got an outside and
yes.
an inside.
Yes.
But I keep limiting the word whole.
Yes.
So, and then it's finished and then it's in the past.
Yes. But the entire thing here is an occurrence that is changing every moment.
Is it like going into an unfamiliar place where as you progress into the unfamiliar place, every experience you have is adding to the possible actualization of the place that you're finally going to experience?
Yes. There's something of it, yes.
Yes, so that, for instance, I might go into a house and I would sort of, I would have in my mind that there would be a lounge and a bathroom and a kitchen. But until I actually, and that's kind of the as a whole, the house as a whole. But then as I experience it, it kind of gets filled in.
Yes.
The unfamiliar house becomes actualized for me from moment to moment as it actualizes for me.
Yes. Now you're catching an aspect of it, Maria. The possibilities that we're projecting every moment become actualized, almost like some kind of object that you can open. You're able to open up different aspects of it that were already there in possibility, but you can open them and actualize them. But the entire field of possibility in which all of this opening of actualization happens is always present as a whole. That's what we're saying.
Is it always present as a whole?
Think of it this way. Think of it that house with all those rooms that you could go in is in a street that you could walk down, which is in a town that you could visit, which is in a country that you could drive through, which is on a planet that you can fly across. Do you see all of those possibilities of you driving down the street, visiting the airport? Do you know they're all actually a part of the field of your possibility, but at any moment when you're in the room, the possibility of you going to the airport and going to Australia is very distant, but it's still there. Do you see that the entire field of possibility that is the world is open to us as a whole in every moment, but we're only immediately, you see, it's structured in such a way as only those parts that we can immediately open are immediately in front of us. Do you see it's got this horizontal structure? The Brisbane Airport for me is actually down one of those possibilities. The possibility of Brisbane Airport for me is there. I've been there before. I'm not consciously projecting it, but it's part of the field of possibility. Like, it's like all of these doors that I can open.
Is it what existentialists call our facticity?
I don't know. I wouldn't like to say. Because it doesn't just mean Brisbane Airport. It means all of the things that I could imagine, all of the feelings that I could experience. Do you know that it's the Nicolette's phrase for it again? It's the great dome of experience. It's like the field of possibilities, the possibility of all you could experience. And it's really based on all you have already experienced, but it's a dome. there's a limit to what's experientiable. But it's not the limits of the edge of the universe. Do you see? It's a different place altogether. Everyone's gone silent, which gives me the chance to read more. That gives me the chance to read more. So, did I get to the end of the slide?
Oh God, I was.
Is anybody awake?
It expands into a whole.
Yes.
I don't think you've quite finished, John.
At this
present.
Yes. Were you away, Rekha?
No.
Oh no.
I just said that I'm still present.
Okay. Yes. Good. Well, I'm going to start on the sentence I think I left off on. The projection is intrinsically completing in the sense of a casting ahead that is the forming of an as a whole into whose realm there is spread out a quite specific dimension of possible actualization. I did read that out. Every projection raises us away into the possible and in so doing brings us back into the expanded breadth of whatever has been made possible. So he's trying to describe this domain of possibility, which is time, right? Because that domain of possibility, in one way of describing it, it's the future. Mm-hmm. But it's not really the future, the clock future. It's this continuous field of becoming in which we live. You know, you're in it now. It's in space, but it's the becoming of you, of what you just said. You know, it's the becoming of the impulse to speak. It's Julie just getting up and doing what she was going to do, right?
We're full
of impulses which are possibilities, which we're manifesting, which are actualizing. But we're always in the field. We're always thrown into the field of what's of our becoming. I mean, it's weird. It doesn't quite feel like that because we're always in the same field, the field of becoming. You know, I know that there's a level here where Heidegger helped me a lot with people who said, well, why don't you just be now? Do you know? Well, that's you're talking there to the part of your brain that is kind of looking up and going, oh, planning your life, you know, having a little dream. Yeah, that being now really means maybe you should stop having a little dream and come down to this moment. But this moment now is actually a continuous becoming of you going into the future. So there's no real being now. In the sense of actually being in an utterly static place, because the being of now is the being of the continuous becoming of your own possibility. All that the be here now statement means is you've left the reality of your Dasein, the reality of your actual becoming, and you're imagining some other becoming that isn't happening.
Would Heidegger say then that another difference between us and animals is that we have the possibility for self-actualization, and animals don't?
Well, I think it's Carl Rogers. Dasein would. Nicolette's been reading Carl Rogers, and she's saying, "Well, it's Carl Rogers." But anyway, Heidegger never talks about self-actualization, but he does talk about. This transposition into Dasein, which I think in a way is, yeah, it's just self-actualization just isn't a Heideggerian term, because it implies in a way, in the language of psychology, that somehow your self is transformed by that, whereas what Heidegger's talking about is just your recognizing in a moment of transposition what is always already happening. It's just that you,
it's for free will, though, isn't it, what he's saying?
Well, I think the only free will may be, and I'm inclined to agree with this as well, the only free will we have is a kind of a negative free will that we can disidentify. It's the freedom of Dasein to return to itself, rather than be identified with whatever is occurring with the beings. But here the beings include all the thoughts and feelings and where they're carrying you off to, including thoughts and feelings that think that they're deciding things and having choices. I think at that level, if you're thinking of free will as you know, deciding what you're going to do this afternoon, I'm not sure that's free will in quotes. Free will is a big subject, Maria, in terms of whether there is anything like...
Let's talk about choice. I mean, he's by becoming more aware that you are in this field of possibilities,
yes,
in which you are continually becoming and in which things are manifesting themselves.
Yes.
You know, if you have that awareness, then you've got a bigger, it's expanded your field of possibilities, hasn't it?
Yes. Yes. But
that's got implications for things like self-actualization, acting authentically, etc., etc. There are implications to this, which I agree that Heidegger doesn't discuss. But I mean, you know, in a way, my question a couple of weeks ago was why bother with all this? Why bother to understand the being of beings? Then what? Well, I think it's beginning to reveal to me that there are some very interesting then whats. That's what I'm saying.
Yes. See, my sense of this is in this projecting of our being in the world. You know, our being thrown into all of our possibilities. Heidegger paints a picture of us really just submitting to the binding that occurs. He doesn't talk about freedom in any positive sense, in the sense of our choosing which possibility to actualize, because I think his sense is that it's Dasein itself that is actualizing these possibilities. It's not our reflective self. So there's a sense in which you could say Dasein is in charge, but it doesn't think and it doesn't reflect. It doesn't decide. Those are things that happen later in the reflecting self that thinks it has free will. I'm inclined to think that is not so. It's part of the projection. But we're into another area here that isn't part of this, because free will is an interesting question in itself. You've got to decide or be clear on who I am first. It's always like this. There clearly are. There seems to be two sort of levels. It's been throughout this course, the level of the reflecting self, and then there's the level of the being that is manifesting this life. And free will often gets, the whole thinking about free will is often unclear about the fact that there's a distinction, and that this downstream reflecting entity is somehow already determined by the manifestation of the world. But I digress. And did I finish that slide, Nicolette?
Yeah, I think you did.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the opening for making possible slide 12. The projection and projecting in themselves raise us away to possibilities of binding and are binding and expansive in the sense of holding a whole before us within which this or that actual thing can actualize itself. Note, it actualizes itself in the field of our own possibility, as what is actual in something possible that has been projected. So do you see the actual thing requires us to have projected its possibility in order for it to manifest itself. This expansion that raises us away and binds us, something that occurs simultaneously in the projection, also shows, however, its intrinsic character of opening. And Julia, you were talking about this, that is it just a fixed projecting? But here he's starting to talk about, no, it's an opening to something. Yet it is not some mere or fixed remaining open for something, neither for what is possible nor even for what is actual. Projecting is not a gaping at what is possible and cannot be such, because whatever is possible as such is precisely stifled in its being possible if we merely observe and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, in a way what we're doing here, that's why I'm smiling carefully, sort of, you know. The actual making possible is occurring in the living moment, and our turning back and reflecting on it isn't really a making possible. We're just talking about what's already been actualized in our reflecting. The moment of being of manifestation has the openness in it. What is possible only essentially prevails in its possibility if we bind ourselves to it in its being made possible. Making possible as such always speaks into what is possibly actual. You see, I think what he's trying to say there is our making possible isn't just an idle fantasy that we're having. It's a making possible in the face of a possible binding. It's a response to something that will bind that making possible. It needs the other side. If you take the other side away, it just becomes an empty circuit which discovers nothing. See, the making possible is has got this intention in it to be transformed into something actual. That's its energy. Making possible as such always speaks into what is possibly actual. Making possible is a prefiguring of actualizing. Yes? Prefiguring of actualizing. Do you see this is exactly what the current brain science is saying the neocortex is doing? It's exactly that, a prefiguring of what is going to be possibly actual. And in, all right, making possible is a prefiguring of actualizing, and indeed in such a way that in the projection We do not in turn accept and take possession of what is actual as something in the possibility that has been actualized. Gosh. Okay. The object of the projection is neither the possibility nor the actuality. The projection has no object at all, but is an opening for making possible. In making possible the originary relatedness of the possible and the actual, of possibility and actuality in general as such is revealed. Have you got that? We're projecting a... No, that's not it. We're projecting a field. But it's not about us just projecting something possible. We're projecting a space within which our making possible can become actual. The intention of the making possible is to make something actual. So do you see we're not even aiming at making actual. We're aiming at opening in a space up where the actual can manifest. But the actual needs our making possible to make it possible for it to manifest.
But it needs the background.
Yes. The background is our
similar things can bind into it and give us some idea of it, but it still isn't all of it.
No.
So it's only... So like if a nuclear bomb went off, you would just experience it as terror, but from different angles and different times, and it would fill in, it would become more dimensional. But you can only... So if you saw a mushroom cloud and I don't know where I'm going now, you already knew what that meant.
Yes.
And it would still be destructive and it would destroy you, but you would know, whereas because you have some points of reference.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know what...
What you're saying is, in effect, your making possible is... determined by your historicity, as Heidegger would say. Your making possible comes out of what you've already made possible. Yes? Rather, what you've already made actual. So what all of your past experience of manifesting possibility and the possibly actual becoming actual is now determines, it changes your making possible so that... You recognize that it's a nuclear bomb going off rather than just a fascinating cloud that looks rather beautiful with all the light coming off it. Do you know everything that in our making possible is coming out of our previous becoming? Yes? All of our becoming is changing the way we, insofar as we encounter some new dimension of the dome of experience, we're continuously changing in our possibly making actual. And we do, even if we're almost completely closed, we still know it's Saturday. Do you know that our knowing it's Saturday comes out of having lived through Friday? So all of that is all happening, it's all part of the making possible. Now, did I get to the end of that?
Yes, you did.
I did.
Oh no.
But it's still happening as a new thing, because even if you've experienced whatever you've experienced, gains a new dimension each time you think about it from your perspective of where you are now.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you've finished
it, John. I'm still thinking about things rather than the whole of everything. Is everything being new all the time?
Yes.
So you can never know the same thing twice.
No.
You can never... It's always something new.
Yes.
Even if it's really familiar.
Yes.
There's always something new.
But you can, in a sense, you can intend something to be the same as it was, even though the actual moment of the manifestation is always different. Within that, you can still intend the computer to be the same computer and Julie to be the same Julie. You know, we still in our intending, we identify things as having an enduring being. Because part of being that we haven't really looked at is, in order for something to have being, it can't just be an instantaneous phenomenon. It has to endure in some way.
Mm.
So in our making possible, we're making possible the enduring of something. You know, our making actual is enabling something that if you looked at the sheer experience, is just changing every moment in quite a chaotic way. Our making possible is an extracting from that chaos, if you like, the presence of an enduring something. Do you see? It's us in a way that collaborate with the possibly actual to manifest something that continues, and it's continuing, its continuation, its endurance, is its being.
Mm.
Yes, even if Alex is still there, the being of justice. We still mean it to be the same thing from one moment to the next. So do you see, being has something of, it has identity in it and sameness, but that's part of our making possible, that we hold that idea of being in us, and that enables a being to be. It's another way of looking at being. Do you see, if we didn't do that, we could treat our entire experience as like a pattern of pixels on a computer screen. We could say, oh, here's a pattern, and 50th of a second, oh, here's another pattern, 50th of a second, oh, here's another pattern, and the only enduring things there are the pixels. And we could say, oh, pixels have being. There aren't any things there. You know, but we don't do that. We don't see pixels or colours or sensations. The possibilities that we manifest are the possibilities of the enduring beings around us. But we do that. But we don't make it up either. It's a meeting of these two streams. Because there is a...
We're maintaining that song, and then we're adding, and then other things are becoming part of our song.
Yes.
And then we keep singing the song, and it combines with other things, and the song changes, but the song is always the same song.
In a way, but one of the tunes that might be playing is the Robin on the Fence. Do you know, in the robin on the fence, you know, we're in charge of its manifesting. You know, we enable it to be. Now, you could say the robin has its own being, but we grant it a being in our seeing it and in our understanding it. And we can, you know, and as you look into the detail of the feather, you know, you see in a way you're bringing that feather as a feather, in as a beautiful feather, you're bringing it into being. Even though the robin is the robin's feather, it's not the beautiful feather that you know, the robin doesn't experience the beauty of the being of the feather.
Because the feather has different meaning to you than it does to the robin.
But the robin, I mean, this is Heidegger's point here, the robin doesn't see the feather as a feather.
No.
Do you see?
What robin sees it as. We don't know.
Well, the assumption, and I think it's a good one, is that the robin sees it as a means for flying, or just like he sees the worm as a means of nutrition.
Yeah, to basic level, yes. But we also don't know.
Well, the reason we would say that we do know is because of the robin doesn't recognize us as a being. The robin reacts to us, even though I have to say that. And I was just reading, Frankl's account of the concentration camps, that sometimes a robin or a bird at a certain moment will land in front of you in such a way that you feel that it's a message from somewhere.
Mm.
Mm. But it's still not the robin looking at you. It's almost like the robin is a messenger. But the robin can be more than
That messenger be part of his being rather than him being manipulated by something which only we can see. I mean, everything's just being together, isn't it? We're all just being different things together.
I don't know. You'll have to...
The robin's in me and I'm in the robin.
Yes. I mean, in Viktor Frankl's book, he'd just been having an intense experience of his love for his wife, and he knew that the robin landing, you know, he's digging a trench somewhere near Auschwitz, that the robin landing there, that's what it, that you can't put it into words, right? That it wasn't his wife, but it was a communication.
Mm.
I'm just saying that birds can do that. I don't know what the bird, the being of the bird, was able to be moved to become that. There's something more extraordinary going on than just feathers and bones and. That's all. I wouldn't like to say what it all meant, but I don't know if you've ever had an experience like that where an animal or some part of nature has actually said something to you.
That projection, isn't it?
Well, it's a synchronicity. I think if I'm going to be Jungian, you feel like there's something in nature that in a way is attuned to how you are. So
is that, or do we read that into it?
I think the answer there is, how could you possibly decide?
Yeah.
Except in so far as when an event like that happens to you, it has kind of meaning to the power of 17. You know, compared to ordinary meaning, it often just beams through to you as such a, you know, if we forget our objective understanding of the universe, some events like that on the meaning scale, they're just more meaningful than other events, and so in a way they're more real. And when you say you project it, it depends what you mean by projection. Because
that we read, you know, the situation was the robin. So he got something from that experience that touched him more than the actual thing should. So, like, you know, you see a robin and it's sweet and it's lovely. But for him, it was something much more meaningful, perhaps because in the situation that he was in, he needed that meaning, or he was looking for that meaning. He was missing, longing for that meaning.
Yes.
And so the robin became the carrier to deliver that.
Yes. But when you say projection, I'm just checking that, because in the ordinary sense of the meaning, We're sort of living in a world where we think there is something like an actual objective physical robin, and then we project something onto that physical robin. Whereas where we are here is that there isn't really a physical Robin. In the first place, the Robin is a projection. We're manifesting. Right. We're manifesting exactly. The Robin in the first place. There's something that comes to meet us. We can't say what it is, except insofar as our experience of the being of the Robin manifests that. Sometimes the Robin can manifest a different kind of meaning, like for Viktor Frankl. And the reason he took it to be a synchronistic sign is because the Robin landed right by his spade and stayed there and looked at him, which is a I don't know if I've had a Robin did that when I was walking with a friend once. Sometimes they do that because they're looking for a worm, you know. Mm-hmm. But he just did it in the moment when Frankl was thinking about his wife. Do you know that there was a synchronicity to it, where there was a sense of the events that we experience are connected in ways that are invisible to us, that aren't purely cause and effect. And I think I'd follow Jung in that. I think there is a deeper significance to the events of our lives, but they only manifest in these intense moments. And they generally do manifest in an intense moment.
Only if we're open to it, no?
Yes, yeah. I did a little sort of minor study on this. I had a friend of mine in Australia did a PhD on synchronicity. He's published a book on it as well, which while he was doing that, he just lived in synchronicity world. Do you know? And really did. I'll just give you one example. He came over to England to visit me, and he went for a dinner the night before he came to see me at his cousin's. And at his cousin's, he met somebody. He met a distant relation of his, who turned out to be an old school friend of mine, who then agreed to go with Lawrence and surprise me at the pub. This is John Trigwell. I hadn't seen him since I was 17. But it just so happened, of course, that Lawrence was the catalyst to cause John Trigwell to suddenly appear back in my life. And so and these kind of events just statistically unlikely way just keep on happening to Lawrence, partly because he's looking for them. I know that, you know, he's looking for them. But at the same time, I think there's something going on. That's the best way I can put it.
So I notice that when I go to festivals, it feels like, you know, everything is in synchronicity.
Yeah.
And it happens much less so in my day to day. So I think, you know, to me, that shows that the more open I am to these experiences, the more synchronicity I see in the world.
Yes. Yes. And that's very informing about the world that we live in is has such a deep belief in that the ground of all the events that happen lies in physical cause and effect, that that's the kind of world we manifest. Do you know, we do manifest the world the way that our projection of the possibilities of the world affects how the world can manifest. So if we were all really, you know, in Lawrence's world, synchronicity world, I think we actually would keep on experiencing synchronistic events, in such a way that the world itself would be different. I mean, I think the world itself is different for pre-scientific cultures, and not you know, in the way that events manifest and things happen. But that's just, you know, we're speculating there as well, of course.
What is Lawrence's name, so I can look for his book?
What's Lawrence's second name? Brown. I called him Synchronicity Brown. It's quite an obscure book, but I think you'll find it on Amazon.
It is, your whole world opens up when something synchronicity style happens, doesn't it? It's like there's just hope in your world then, because nothing is the way you thought it was.
Yeah, yeah, no, this great kind of net, this chain of physical cause and effect, you know, it's deadly. But it's okay. We live under it because that's the way, that's our society, right? That's it. We exchanged synchronicity for comfort and convenience, you know, so that the trains run more or less on time and there's stuff in the shops and, you know, all the rest of it. We've so regulated ourselves that we've enforced this kind of form of cause and effect that we live under, because we want everything to be predictable.
And now that's all been put up on its head.
Oh yeah, we're going through a little bit of instability, and how much are we enjoying that? You know,
I like the possibility of reset and a new way of life.
I guess a lot depends on whether your pension fund is invested in the stock market.
And yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, a bit more than that, but you know, we won't go there. I mean, the last time I was in India, I thought, you know, that's too disordered for me. I do appreciate order as well. But let's get back to the slide. Nicolette's giving me the John, get on with it. Have I finished that slide? The opening for Making Possible. Let's say I have.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The look into the light. Now we're getting a little bit of poetry. Slide 13. Projecting as this revealing that pertains to making possible is the proper occurrence of that distinction between being and beings. It is the eruption into this between of the distinction. So, it first makes possible the terms that are distinguished in their distinguishability. Projection unveils the being of beings. Because it's only in projection that things become actual and manifest. And being actual and manifest is the appearance of being. It's where beings become beings. So in that place where beings become beings, we experience what being is. It is the look into the light of a possible making possible in general. Do you see that? In a logical sense, making possible has being in it, right? What is it that you are making possible in your making possible? You're making being possible. The look into the light tears darkness as such along with it, gives the possibility of that dawning of the everyday in which at first and for the most part we catch sight of beings, cope with them, suffer from them and enjoy ourselves with them. When he says the look into the light tears darkness as such along with it. He means, I think, that this moment of being, I'm getting a knock on the door now, this moment of the manifestation of being becomes covered over. Yes. Yeah. Can you shut the door, Nicolette? Sorry, where were we? Yes, the darkness. There's a covering over of the moment of this manifestation, of the occurrence, if you like, of the making possible with the possibly actual. There's a cover of darkness, if you like, that goes over it, because in our everydayness, we're utterly concerned with the beings that have manifested, not with the actual manifestation itself. Do you see? So the manifesting of being covers itself over, it conceals itself, so that we remain to use Bortov's phrase, downstream of it. Third paragraph, the look into the light of the possible makes whatever is projecting open for the dimension of the either or. Sorry, I'll start again. The look into the light of the possible makes whatever is projecting open for the dimension of the either or, the both and, the in such a way and the otherwise, the what, the is and the is not. Now, if you recall from our earlier lecture, he's talking here about the Logos Apophantikos. These are all the distinctions that we can make about being. Something is either this or that, or it's both and something, or exists in such a way that the board is black. There is the otherwise. Things are this way, but they could be otherwise. There is the what something is. There is the fact that something is, and there's the fact that something isn't. All of these, emerge, let me put it again, out of our look into the light of the possible. Do you see these are all... Somebody's making a noise. Kind of an electronic... somebody who's typing at their keyboard, I think. Not sure. No, it's maybe dying off now.
But not anymore.
No, the look into the light of the possible makes whatever is projecting open for the dimension of what we call the Logos Apophantikos. Yes? It opens it up in such a way that we can then look back on it with our reflecting intelligence and make these distinctions that language, logical language, enables us to do. Only in so far as this eruption has occurred do the yes and no and questioning become possible. Yes? It's an eruption of being. Final paragraph. The projection... Yes?
Eruption like with eruption like volcanoes?
So I think he uses erupt with an E and erupt with an I, there's a difference in the meaning of the two, isn't there? And a volcano erupts, doesn't it?
Mm.
Whereas an eruption is something, I think it occurs within. I think when something erupts, it's something that's happening within you. But somebody might care to look up the meaning, that if there is a distinction or if they're synonyms. My feeling of the words is an eruption, is like if something suddenly arises in me, it's an eruption. But if it comes out of me, it's an eruption.
It says here, eruption with an I means bursting or breaking in. Eruption
out.
Means bursting or breaking out.
Well, that's, I was right. So the eruption is something that where it bursts in on me, and the eruption is where it comes out of me. Yeah, so it wasn't bad, was it?
No.
Nicola thinks that's funny. She thinks that's funny. So the final paragraph, the projection raises us away into and thus unveils the dimension of the possible in general. And what is possible is in itself already articulated into possibly being in such a way or otherwise. Got that? We're already in that dimension. Into the possibility of being or not being. Something has become actual, but in that, in its becoming actual, its very becoming actual had the possibility of it not becoming actual, if it's non-being. Its non-being is already there as a shadow of its being. And in a way, all of that just lost. Julie, are you still there? Are you still there? Yeah, we're having a little reorganization, yeah. Final sentence. In projection, there occurs the letting prevail of the being of beings in the whole of their possible binding character in each case. All right? The whole... You're presenting an entire field of possibility within which there is a letting prevail of the being of beings. This is every moment. In projection, world prevails. Oh, I'm getting very optimistic here. 6 minutes to two, and there's only two slides to go. The eruption of the as. The logos, and it was called language and meaning, so finally we're back to the logos. The logos, in accordance with its possibility, is grounded in the originary unity of synthesis and diuresis. Diuresis is separation. Projection is an occurrence which, as raising us away and casting us ahead, takes apart diuresis. In that apartness of a raising away. You see our being thrown out of being itself, although he doesn't say that, into these possibilities. The possibilities are an articulation of what could be. It's an already, you, if you like, being is the unity of everything. But our being cast out of being is an into this field of possibility is our articulation of being into all of the possible ways that being could manifest. So it's a separating out of what, in a certain sense, if we took away space and time, which are the dimensions of our projection, would just be an undifferentiated unity. I always hold this in the background. I got it from Schopenhauer. You know, part of the projection that Heidegger doesn't talk about is it's a spatio-temporal one. So if you want to understand where it's coming from, take away space, take away time. What have you got? Well, there's no way without space or time that you can distinguish anything from anything else. So you just have an inexpressible unity of being. Do you see that in a way that is what lies behind our manifesting of being, is the undifferentiated unity of being, something that you just couldn't possibly experience, because you can only experience being insofar as you've differentiated it in space and time, basically. Yeah. Well, and we're often, I mean, a lot of people who study philosophy, they say, yeah, but oh, so we're manifesting being. So what's behind it? What's the really real being then? behind our manifestation and our projection. What is there really? Well, you see, if you take away the projection for us, there's nothing. It's an inexperiential unity which where nothing's differentiated from anything else. So there's nothing we can say about it, right? There's nothing to experience. There's nothing to say. Can you see why there needs to be a being like us that manifests being? There's a semi-religious understanding of this, that God needed us because God is that undifferentiated being, and God doesn't experience anything. So how's God going to know God? God's only going to know God through the manifestation of what is in beings like us. Or if you don't like the word God, use the word being. Being obviously had some kind of impulse to know itself, and we are that impulse. And from that perspective, every moment is good for that undifferentiated being. Only it's not, because of course it wouldn't know what was good, because in order to know what's good, you have to know what's bad, and you have to be a being like us, where everything has been separated out into a field of possibility. Do you see how universal this is? And I'd like to mention again that if you look into quantum mechanics, you find this reflected at the very lowest level. If you just look into matter far enough, you just end up with something very much like this. You know, entangled particles, when two entangled particles are split apart and then one is measured to find out what spin the particle has, absolutely instantaneously that sets or fixes the spin of the other particle, even though that particle may be several light years away. So they aren't separate. That's a demonstration that these two things that appear separated in space aren't separate. So the quantum mechanics already demonstrates that the matter that we see spread out in space and time at that level is not separate. We separate it in order to know it. You have to separate it in order to know it. We are the devices, if you like, that can achieve that. And we're just sort of, you know, there's a certain level here where every moment we're a kind of a miracle. If the universe had anything in mind for us, it's just for us to manifest being every moment. I don't know if the universe did have anything in mind for us, but that's not a bad myth. I think it is a myth, but I like that as a myth myself. Now, where is anyone?
Yeah, precisely.
Precisely.
Yeah, precisely. Didn't you?
Yeah, precisely. Oh, I was in the middle of a sentence. So takes apart. That's where I got to. Diuresis, and in that apartness of erasing away. Okay. Yet precisely in such a way that there occurs an intrinsic turning toward on the part of whatever has been projected. You see, because get the thing here, we keep raising ourselves up and thinking, oh, I'm looking at the projection from the outside. But really, we are projected ourselves. So, yet precisely in such a way that there occurs an intrinsic turning toward on the part of whatever has been projected, such that which has been projected is that which binds and binds together. So I don't know if you've got the feeling here. Oh yeah, I'm glad you got the sound off, Anthony. He's almost like his Anthony's sneeze. You know, it's like we sneeze, you know, we go, ah, and out come all the possibilities. But with all of that possibility, we ourselves are thrown out, and we've separated everything out into what could be possible. But then in the turning back, which is the manifestation of what is actual, it's all joined together again in the unity of the prevailing of the world as a whole. Which, do you see, despite all of the bits, but bit, all of the experiences that you're having now, the field of the manifestation of being is a unity. That's just the nature of it, right? It's not, there's no two halves. There's no, I'm having an experience over there and an experience over there and they're divided. Somehow or other, in an extraordinary way that is very difficult to explain, but we do directly experience, every moment of our lives is a unity. And not only that, it's not as if there's one moment and then a gap and then the next. It streams as an unbroken unity every moment, right to going to sleep. And you can't really say that you experience a break when you go to sleep. You just experience a fading away, don't you? There's never any... It's like the edge of your visual field. You can't look over there and say, oh, there's the black bit, the bit where there's nothing. I keep trying to find it, and that it's not there. Wherever I look, there's something. And yet, at the same time, the visual field is bounded, isn't it? Do you see how there's a... That's like the... Like, I think, Julie, you were thinking of this. So is this whole, this as a whole, bounded? Well, no, it doesn't have a boundary. There's no fixed boundary. There's not even... It's impossible because, you see, wherever you look for a boundary, it opens up a new possibility. Do you see where... That's like the visual field. You think there's a boundary there? No, just look. No, there's no boundary there. There's another possibility over there. It's the wall. See, the field of possibility, as it stretches into time, is unbounded. And yet in each moment, it's complete. It's paradoxical. All right, where am I?
Projection is that
originarily simple occurrence which intrinsically unites contradictory things, binding together and separating. Do you see it does both at the same time? In a way that defies... If you were trying to explain this to a computer in logical terms, what experience is like, it would come back and after having crunched itself logically and said, well, that's impossible. You can't have an experience of things being separated and bound at the same time. And yet, that's what we do have. Yet, as the forming of the distinction between possible and actual in its making possible, and as the eruption with an I into the distinction between being and beings, or more precisely, as the erupting of this between, this projection of possibility, this projection is also that relating in which the as springs forth. So this is a big subject, the as for this for late in the day. We always experience everything as something. It's to do with intentionality. It's another way of expressing intentionality. Do you see that we don't... If I speak in Husserlian terms, we don't experience consciousness as such, unless we are very we have to go into rather a special state of disidentification. But in our experience of the world, we don't see consciousness. Consciousness always presents us as a consciousness of something. You're conscious of me speaking. You're conscious of the things in the room. And they're everything that you experience is presenting itself as being such and such. It's already invested with meaning. You don't ever encounter a kind of unless you've had some very strange experience, which people say they've had, but I haven't. You don't ever encounter an uninterpreted experience. Even if you said, "Oh yeah, I'm having an experience. I've shut my eyes." There's just a field of sensation. The little fine grainy sensation that goes on in the back of your eye. You say, "There's an uninterpreted experience. There's some ground of." You say, "No. What you're experiencing is the little grainy thing. The little grainy thing that happens when you shut your eyes. Every experience you have comes with an already interpreted meaning in it. Yes? You don't ever get the raw material. There's no such thing as the raw material of uninterpreted experience, despite many philosophers having imagined that there's such a thing. So the projection of possibilities is a projection of meaning, which means...
I'm sorry, I don't understand that, because we often say, "I didn't know what that was."
Yes. So let me answer that, Maria. When you say, "I didn't know what that was," you mean I wasn't able to pin it down in its specificity.
Yes, I mean, I'm thinking of...
So let me say, you interpreted, it came with the meaning of something, it would have been a very broad class of thing, like it's definitely a physical object, for instance. Yes?
You could say it's a feeling, or it's a bodily experience.
Yes, it comes with a meaning. But sometimes things come with a meaning, and you realize it's a vague there's something unspecified in it that you could specify further. But do you see that everything comes like that? It's like,
otherwise you can't remember it, can you?
But no, but everything comes like that. It's more what that expression is that something's appeared to me I'm not sure what to call it. I don't have a name for it. Or something's appeared to me and I do have a vague name for it. It's a piece of furniture, but I don't know exactly what kind of a piece of furniture it is. What you're asking for really is you want to be able to specify in more detail, but it hasn't emerged. What I'm saying, something that was uninterpreted would emerge as something like... it would be terrifying, I think, if something emerged into your experience that was utterly alien.
Like a blind person seeing something for the very first time.
But even then, the blind person would have heard all of us talking about sight. And even then, our making possible will relate it to something. It'll say, because you already had a sense of space and you would have already had some kind of imagination of what seeing colour could possibly be like. Of course, when colour does hit you, it's hitting you for the first time as something actual that has something that you didn't anticipate in it. But nothing arrives completely unanticipated. Even if you had to even if you have to unbind and rebind. So when I'm saying that nothing arrives uninterpreted, I don't mean that everything arrives fully understood. I don't understand that is a kind of interpretation, right?
You classified it as a thing you don't understand.
Yeah, yes. But you've classified it as a thing you don't understand within a boundary of understanding it. Yes, within a background of... It just, do you see, what I'm thinking of is something uninterpreted would be, it wouldn't be an object. It wouldn't be in space and time. You know, as soon as something appears as an object in space and time, you at least know it's an object in space and time. Something completely uninterpreted would be terrifying because it would open up a dimension of experience even greater than somebody who was blind who suddenly started to see. It would be a bit more like somebody who was blind who lived with other blind people and didn't even know there was such a thing as sight. That would be more getting closer to it.
Okay.
Yes? So getting the idea of the as is quite important because, again, it's to do with language. Because if you know that's what Helen Keller was, the situation she was in, which she didn't know what water is. She didn't have the as for that experience of the splashing on her hands. And when she got language, she knew the as. She knew she knew what the experience meant. And if you know what the experience means, that's the heart of the experiencing something as. Helen's experiencing the splashing of that sensation on her hands. Suddenly she experiences it as water. And it was language that... Somebody's dropping crockery in the background.
I know, my son broke a bowl before, now someone else has broken one. The chances
are bad. Oh, it's just... There's some strange energies going around. So, God, where am I?
We simply never
first have something and then something more and then the possibility of taking something as more, but the complete reverse. Something first gives itself to us only when we are already moving within projection, within the as. Final slide. Enthusiasmos. In the occurrence of projection, world is formed. I.e., in projecting, something erupts and irrupts toward possibilities, thereby erupting into what is actual as such, so as to experience itself as having erupted, as an actual being in the midst of what can now be manifest as beings. It is a being of a properly primordial kind which has erupted to that way of being which we call Dasein. So Dasein has erupted. And I think we're going to say that the possibilities then erupt.
Does it mean like Dasein? Is it like one? Is it...
It's pretty much a translation to being.
Yes.
So da is... Dasein, yeah. Sein is being.
But what we often wonder is, does each one of us have their own Dasein, or is there just Dasein? Mm-hmm. And I think Heidegger's a bit ambiguous about this. I mean, what in the English philosophical translation of Dasein, it's their being.
Mm-hmm.
Which means it's the being, it's not just pure being, it's the being of the one who is being projected into the there. You're being projected into the there of the possibilities that are being actualized. It's a their being. It's not just a pure being in the utter stillness of nothing happening. It's a being projected, it's a projected being, a there being. So that's why.
Yeah. We also refer to it. So in German, we can say like, somebody lift their Dasein in such and such way.
Yes.
So it's also a very private thing, I guess. It's sort of like an all-encompassing private. Yeah, the way you are in your life, you live your life.
But it's common
use in German.
Yeah, every day it's Dasein, yeah.
So it's
Dasein.
It's the mode of being that is specific to human beings.
Yeah.
So animals don't have Dasein.
No. Well, maybe they do, but we wouldn't use the words like that.
And for Heidegger wouldn't either. It's the being. It's the manner of being for the being to whom beings are manifest. And it's the essence of human being that beings are manifest to us, not that we're animals with a bit of rationality thrown on top. The essence of our being is that beings are manifest to us, which is what he means when we say it's that being which we say exists with a little hyphen as an exiting from itself. In the essence of its being, yet without abandoning itself. Do you see he's attempting to describe a mode of being that is absolutely what we are every moment? I think we're even when we dream, possibly deep dreamless sleep, we get a rest. But in terms of getting a rest, our rest in deep dreamless sleep is a non-experience for us. If it's anything, it would be a retreat into the originary undifferentiated being, which is in a way a kind of non-being, a non-experience. So, man, final paragraph. I think Alex is gone. Alex, are you there? Boris, are you still there?
How are you?
Well done, Boris. I think we lost Alex somewhere, but everyone else is here. So man is that inability to remain and yet is unable to leave his place. In projecting, the Dasein in him constantly throws him into possibilities and thereby keeps him subjected to what is actual. So this answers, Maria, what you were saying. The freedom that Heidegger's talking about pertains to Dasein and not to the one who's being projected. The one who's being projected is subjected to the actual. But it's Dasein itself, if you like, that freely binds itself to what is actual. Thus, thrown in this throw, man is a transition. Lovely. Transition as the fundamental essence of occurrence. Man is enraptured in this transition. Enraptured by this very experience of being thrown. Of course we are. If we weren't enraptured, we wouldn't have bought the ticket. You know, who'd put themselves through this really voluntarily? I mustn't be pessimistic. It's only because we think there must be something marvellous in the experience, isn't it? That we would undergo it. We're enraptured by it. This manifesting of world. Anyway, back. Man is enraptured in this transition and therefore essentially absent. Absent in a fundamental sense. Absent from the place from which he's been thrown. That means. Absent in a fundamental sense. Absent in a fundamental sense. Never simply at hand. His idea of things being at hand is the at-handness of an object that you can pick up. never simply at hand, but absent in his essence, in his essentially being away, removed into essential having been and future, essentially absencing and never at hand. So he's talking about our being thrown into time, how our projecting is determined by our having been, and it's a continuous projecting into the future. Whereas, what does he mean by our essence? Well, our essence, I guess, is the place from out of which this throw is occurring. So we're continually being thrown out of what we would call our essence. I mean, my picture of the essence is would be where you go when you fall completely and absolutely unconscious. So we're continually being thrown out of that. So absence in his essence, in his essentially being away, removed into essential having been and future, essentially absencing and never at hand, yet existent in his essential absence. So he sometimes calls it an abyss, the sense that we're in this continual state of becoming. This is a continual state of being thrown into time. And yet we exist in that state. Do you see there's a sense in which that's how it is for us? We live in a state of this continuous being thrown into the future. Transposed into the possible. You see, the possible is a kind of non-being, isn't it? Yeah. Our being is a being transposed continuously into a projecting of what is possible. It's weird, isn't it? Isn't it weird? I mean, it is. He's not making it up, is he? Well, I don't think he's making it up. He's trying to indicate something. He's indicating something. There's many ways you could say it, and Heidegger's saying it in his way, and he's emphasizing it in his way. And he's saying it in a Heideggerian way. But I think what he's indicating is an aspect of something that we all experience, even though he's highlighted it in his Heideggerian light. Let me finish now. Transposed into the possible, he must constantly be mistaken concerning what is actual, because we're always experiencing what is possible and waiting for the possibly actual. And only because he is thus mistaken and transposed can he become seized by terror. Let me leave that as one side before. And only where there is the perilousness of being seized by terror do we find the bliss of astonishment, being torn away in that wakeful manner that is the breath of all philosophizing, and which the greats among the philosophers called enthusiasmos. Now, I've left that final statement there because I do not experience being seized by terror. Not in this way, anyway. Now, does that mean I'm not understanding what Heidegger's saying? Have I not got to the very depths of Dasein? That's possible. I mean, in a way, I'd have to get back to you and give this course again in 3 or 4 years, maybe longer. I know there's an essential aspect to Dasein that we haven't looked at, which is to do with death, which is to do with there's something essential in this being projected into the possibility, that is the recognition that the unavoidable possibility of this projection is our death, which is the end of our projecting. You see, there's an aspect to that where in our everyday projection, we don't fully see that death is looking at us. Now, I think there's an aspect of what Heidegger's saying here where there's a terror in the seeing that our projection into time is finite, that it ends. We don't like to see that. We like to stay with a sense that this projecting that we're engaged in is going to go on forever. And yet it is clearly not, right? And it doesn't, because every night we go to sleep and that seems all right, the end of the projection. But we go to sleep on the understanding that we will always return to this state of being projected. Now, I think for Heidegger, he's had some kind of experience of the sort of existential position of our being projected like this, that it's only a temporary situation that we're in, and in a way our projection, our becoming, is occurring over an abyss of our extinction, our not projecting, our absence. Now I'm only giving you this is where I follow Heidegger so far, and then I find that I don't know. For me, you see, I'm a bit more like Schopenhauer. I have a sense that that there is something eternal in me.
There's the poem, John.
Yes, I didn't want to read the poem. There's the Nietzsche poem, but it doesn't come. It doesn't. I don't relate to the Nietzsche poem. There's a Nietzsche poem at the end that Nicolette says there's a poem. So Nicolette's going to come and read it.
I'll read you the poem. Yeah. I don't know if you've all read the reading, but the last lines of his book, which John was just talking about, was from Friedrich Nietzsche, from The Song of Zarathustra's, which he called The Intoxicated Song. And it goes like this. And it's in which we also experience the world. O man, attend. What does deep midnight's voice contend? I slept my sleep, and now awake at dreaming's end. The world is deep, deeper than day can comprehend. Deep is its woe, joy deeper than heart's agony. Woe says, fade, go. But all joy wants eternity, wants sleep. Wants deep, profound eternity. That was meaningful to me anyway when I read it. So
yeah, hey-ho. And I was talking about eternity. Eternity, just in the sense that there's some deep in the heart of the light of now, there is something that is unchanging. I tend to look toward that rather than the abyss of my extinction.
I think Heidegger's terror is something deeper than just being pissed off about dying, which is you know, I mean, the idea that we're not going to exist as these individual people anymore, which admittedly could be a bit upsetting. But I think this deep terror is something more akin to what Sartre touches on in Nausea, about the horror of existence, of the existence of things.
Yes.
Devoid of language, devoid of our separating it out and understanding it. It can be a terrifying experience. Whether those experiences are born of mental illness, I don't know. But, I mean, I've experienced it. It's not pleasant. You know, some people call it angst, anguish. It's not really just about... It's not just about the fact you're going to die. It's something about the nature of what surrounds you, your own body. I think it goes deeper than that, myself.
Yes.
But it's quite deep though, Maria, dying. It's a very deep thing to lose. For me, it's very scary, the thoughts of losing all that I know. It's very because I don't know what death is. It can trigger in you quite a deep. I'm not saying, you know, it can trigger in you a very great fear of what that. I can't. It's almost inexplicable to describe.
Depends what you believe, but I mean,
well, it's not what I believe.
I was a lot more scared of death when I was a Catholic, because it's like, you know, endless.
Okay,
endless,
bye,
endless
Anthony.
Misery and anguish,
bye.
But just non-existence.
Bye bye.
Sorry guys, I would have to go.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Fuck.
Bye. We've done the course. We're just wrapping up now. Bye,
yeah,
Anthony.
Bye.
Yes.
Bye.
Yeah.
Bye.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye, Anthony.
Yeah. Yes.
John, are we going to have an assignment?
You just let me join in with Nicolette there. You see, I guess it's only been in a few moments of my life that I've really understood that I'm going to die. So it's not a matter of thinking about death. Thinking about death is not the same as... a sort of a realization of your certain extinction. I don't know how to put it, because I think maybe there's a terror there that's akin to the terror of that you're talking about.
Yeah, I think they're similar.
I think they're related.
Mm. Yeah, I'd say they were related, because I could also feel terrified about being here. I don't right now feel terrified about being here in this world, but I have definitely had experiences of being terrified, really terrified of being here in this earth, in this body, but also that it seems to be connected to also. So I don't know. I can't explain it, but it can be connected to the loss of it all going. There being no sensory existence, and there not being any me anymore. Anyway, yeah.
So I think with, you know, when you're talking about, there can be, I mean, I felt it a long time ago, a kind of a sense in me that my egoic self was going to be destroyed. Not that I was going to die, but that the kind of a structure of what you call my egoic self was going to be destroyed, as in couldn't sustain itself, it was just going to break down. I didn't quite know where that was going to lead, but that was the beginning of a certain terror for me as well. And I think it's the same. It's that's why I mean, because death, I think, means the same thing, really. It's the destruction of the egoic self. It's no longer going to have its projected experience. But often when people think about death, it's the egoic self has already abstracted itself from the event of death and is thinking about it. Do you know, it's another one of those downstream things where you think about death, but you're thinking it from this sort of invulnerable place of reflection. Whereas if the actual egoic self gets a real sense that its own annihilation is going to occur, I think it becomes terrified. Whether that's a psychological annihilation or the ending of the body. But we tend to think at a certain level, because it's all gone on and on and on up until now, and we can never remember it not ever having not gone on and on, that it's going to go on and on and on, and death is some sort of transition to another state. I think that's quite deep in us as well. I wouldn't like to say, how can I say? You know, I think somewhere my sense of not being terrified and that there is an eternity in now is a kind of some sort of sense like that my consciousness is beyond time, so it can't really perish. If you get the idea of an absolute and utter and total annihilating perishing, it's unsettling. It's definitely unsettling. And not something that I would say, you know, I think, oh great, I'll go for another spell of terror so that I can, you know, really get deeper into philosophy. I guess I don't find that you have to experience terror in order to appreciate the miracle of the manifestation of being, which I think is what we've been looking at here. So I'm sort of drawing to the end.
Yeah.
Are we got any final questions, statements, sneezes?
I would like you to listen to Josephine Foster's track Eternity, because I think you'll like it. And she also did a whole album of Goethe in German, which I like less. But she's amazing. And her track Eternity, because you were talking about eternity, it just has this amazing. She's just, and she's quite young. I think there's lots of archetypes and things going on in this, or I think you would like her.
All right, Nicolette's writing it down. Have you got a pen, Nicolette?
I've written it down.
Josephine.
Sorry, I've written it.
Yeah.
My favorite thing in the world. She's like the best musician ever, and she's not like a human. She's fantastic. No,
that's a good thing, is it, to be not like a human?
She's like a high priestess. She's fantastic. She's called Josephine Foster.
Yeah, Nicolette's got it down.
Yeah, I've written it down.
It's written down.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll check it out. So, I mean, I've got a... Rekha, are you still there? No, she's gone.
She's gone.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you are. Oh, you are.
Yeah, I just have my microphone off sound so that all the noises in here don't disturb
yes,
the rest.
Yes, yes. So to sort of wrap things up, I don't know what I'm going to do next. I think I'm probably going to be running another course in September, but I don't know if I'm going to do another introduction to phenomenology or just invent a whole new course. I'd like to sort of stay vaguely in touch now we've got Skype going. I think I'd like to call a meeting sometime to kind of discuss what we might like to do. If there is something you'd like to do, you know, to look
sounds
into.
Good.
I was thinking of something to do with Carl Jung. I mentioned that before, but I'm not.
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah, yeah. Which it's going a bit off script for the philosophy school at FUB, because they've got their own psychology school, and you know, if I know academics, they don't like unqualified people poaching on their property. But I think we could do Jung as a kind of reading group, you know, where I'm not setting myself up as an authority, just as it would be. I think very. I'd like to go into the psychological aspects of philosophy, really. That's what it is. I think it's you can't really divide them up. Do you know? I think they're one subject. So we've looked at a lot of in terms of Heidegger, without considering the human psyche itself. And I think Jung's a good way in, and so does Recker. Yes.
For sure.
Yes.
So is there anything, like, should we maybe start looking at books and ideas, or are you going to have a think about it and let us know what we should read, if we should read anything? Because we probably all have plenty of time now.
Yes, well, you know, we're all, especially self-isolating people, thinking, oh, God, please help me. Let me Skype somebody and talk about some transcendental ideas.
That's wonderful. Yeah.
I think language is a really interesting subject for me, which is why I'd quite like to do an assignment.
Ah, yes. I'm sorry, I ignored that because I haven't thought of an assignment, really. Okay. I'll get back to you, Maria, and think of something over the weekend. I mean, I know it's going to be probably quite a big ask. I know what I'm going to ask. I'm going to ask you what you think language is. I might be a bit more, you know, related to what we've covered in the course, obviously, but finally, when it comes down to it, I just haven't answered that question, have I? Not really. But I think we've peddled around it in such a way that I'd like to ask you now. So it's not a regurgitation of what I've told you, because that would be quite hard, wouldn't it?
I read that last reading.
Yes.
Of Heidegger.
Yes.
There's something in there, isn't there, which one could use?
Yes. Yes, I don't know if everybody knows, but I put up a topic 6, which we're not teaching, which is the way to language, which is later Heidegger's thinking on language, which I didn't feel that I was qualified to make sense of. That's partly why I deliberately left it at the end there, you know. It's like, we could do it. I mean, well, I could read it and I could say, well, what do you think that means? Because I don't know. But that's probably not the best way to... There are bits there. There's certainly bits there that you can get something from. But I feel it was a bit early in my career to try and give a lecture on the way to language. Because it's so close to poetry. And it's very hard. I don't quite see what Heidegger's seeing. He's either gone beyond my insight, or he's gone wrong. it's very hard to tell with a philosopher. If you can't follow the philosopher, it's also possible that the philosopher has gone wrong. You know, just because Heidegger was brilliant at a certain point in his career doesn't mean that he didn't lose the plot after his nervous breakdown in the Second World War. You know, that I have a suspicion that some of the clarity of his philosophy was lost after the war. But there you go. I can't say. Because I'm always surprised by Heidegger. You know, there are things I think he's talking rubbish, and then later I have to change my mind. And the way to language may be one of those things that if I give it a bit more time, particularly if I'm foolish enough to say I will teach it, that often helps me to come to an understanding of things. But for now, you know, and I'm interested in Gurdjieff as well. I mean, I'm quite interested in the thing about psychology is we're stepping off there's a kind of a safe platform we're on here where we're just discussing ideas. And the further you get into psychology, the closer you start getting to people's personal lives. You know, it's almost unavoidable. So we have to, you know, I feel like I have to sign a big disclaimer to say I'm not qualified to help anyone psychologically. But I do think that Jung's ideas just in themselves are very clarifying about our position here. It's you see, unless you know what it is, what human beingness is, unless you know the situation we're in, you know what. How can you be clear with your philosophy? So
you don't actually want us to answer that, though.
No, that's a rhetorical question. But yes, Rekha, you were saying, I think, you know, the best introduction to Jung is his autobiography.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, good way to start, yeah, sure.
Yeah. That's me, I've got his autobiography, and then I've got his complete works, you know, so there's no little second introductory volume there. I mean, I can start looking through for some good introductory pieces there.
Wasn't he also the one who sort of believed in the idea of collective consciousness?
Well, collective unconsciousness. The collective unconscious, the place of the archetypes. So he's got a... that's his... He claims it's empirical, that he's recognised the functioning of these unconscious archetypes in the dreams and neuroses and psychoses of his patients, but also in the way that civilization has changed. I mean, in a sense, he understands what happened in Germany as a sort of a psychosis.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
I'm going for a walk. Nicolette's going for a walk. If I don't shut up, she's going to go without me. So I think we've got some kind of means while this health emergency is on to meet, haven't we? So I think we might. I'll stay in touch by email, and
sure.
I think we might have a Jung class. See who turns up and see how it goes. Yeah.
Let's do that. Yeah, all the best to both of you.
Yes.
I hope you stay well.
You. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Wow. Nicolette's ready to go.
It's sunny. I've got to get out. It's so sunny. Well, kind of sunny.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right. Take care, Nicolette.
Yeah, yes. You too. Bye. Lovely to see you all.
Yes.
Lovely.
Yes.
Bye. Bye, Maria.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Jules. Bye, Boris.
Yes.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Be in touch. Farewell. I'm closing it off now. Call ends. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
It's refusing to end. It won't end. I'm pressing...
Sorry.